right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. All right, I got some guys that never got haircuts right here. I'm talking about some rock and rollers. I'm talking about Last in Line. That's Ronnie James Dio original band featuring Vivian Campbell, featuring Vinny Appice, and featuring Jimmy Bain. Then Jimmy Bain passed away last year. We'll get to talk all about that. He was replaced by former Ozzy Osbourne bass player Phil Soussan. So we got a lot of great stories about the early days of the Ronnie James Dio band. Some great stories about the Ultimate Sin Ozzy Osbourne lineup. We got Viv talking about how he met Ronnie, how they found their sound, the success, and even the events that led to Vivian's not agreeable departure from Dio. He's speaking very candidly and openly about his relationship with Ronnie James Dio and why he felt putting together Last in Line after Ronnie's death was a great way to pay tribute to the singer's music. And of course, Viv's going to talk all about the album Last in Line recorded, Heavy Crown, featuring singer Andrew Freeman, about the tour that starts this Friday, October 21st. They got a handful of dates in the States, and then they can take off for a bunch of shows in Europe. You can get tickets and buy a copy of the Last in Line record at lastinlineofficial.com. Check out the band, and you're going to love this interview. Like I said, you get a real great insight into Ozzy and Dio in the 80s, plus Hearing Aid. Remember Hearing Aid? If you're a heavy metal fan, you know that Hearing Aid was the We Are the World, the Tears Are Not Enough for the heavy metal set, all put together by Vivian and Ronnie James Dio and the late, great Jimmy Bain. Talking all about that stuff. Plus, we're talking about getting tickets for the Last in Line shows and also getting tickets for Talk is Jericho Live in Toronto with AJ Styles, which has happened November 20th at the Bassett Theater in Toronto. Starts at 10 a.m. Toronto time in the morning. There's going to be a brunch with AJ and myself that starts at that time. There's a handful of tickets left for that, but those are going really fast. Then we got a few tickets left for the exclusive VIP meet and greet. You go to markoutmoments.com to get your tickets to all of those things, the live podcast, the brunch, the meet and greet. Once again, Talk is Jericho Live with my old tag team partner and WrestleMania rival, AJ Styles. Sunday, November 20th at the Bassett Theater in Toronto. Get your tickets at markoutmoments.com. You're not going to want to miss it. If you saw Talk is Jericho Live in New York with Christian, you know how much fun it was. And with AJ Styles, it's going to be even more fun because he is the world champion right now on the SmackDown brand. All right. So we're here with Vivian Campbell and Phil Soussan from Last in Line in the famous Sunset Marquee Hotel.
Woohoo, yeah.
Which is the rock and roll kind of a destination place if you're in a band in LA.
Yeah, I was just telling my mom earlier, this was the first hotel that I stayed at when I first came to LA, and I think it was in 1985 or something.
Really? Well, when I was first staying in hotels in LA, it was Dio days. We stayed at the Riot House.
That's the other one.
Yeah, they wouldn't spring for anything this push. You know? But it was all good.
Because you always hear about the Hyatt House, but it really was kind of a little bit of a dive, right?
Yeah, it was. It was a dump. Yeah, they've done it up now. It's not even called the Hyatt anymore. But it was a shitty hotel, you know. But I think bands stayed there because they let you ride motorcycles down the corridor, sort of thing. Throw TVs out the window.
The old Led Zeppelin tales, right?
Yeah.
I think they just counted on that to get their redecorating done from time to time. It was like, okay, ride the bikes. Yeah. Here's the bill.
Trash the room.
And it's all very civilized. Now you get fruit and flowers and a bottle of red wine. And
it's really quite posh, right?
I thought that was one of your hats, actually, Viv. I wasn't sure.
that could be afterwards.
Yeah. Looks like a grandma's hat, right? But it's interesting to me because you guys, I mean, we talked about kind of being here in the 80s and stuff, and now, Phil, you're in Last in Line. Mm. And have you guys known each other since that time frame?
Pretty much.
I mean, we've obviously, as you know, the music business is such a small world, and even if, you know, I've never had the pleasure of working with Viv, but we've always sort of crossed paths along the way, and, you know, been friendly with a lot of the other people in our bands, and all these bands are, as you know, they're kind of a musical chairs a lot of the time. So, you know, you know somebody in this band, and then you know somebody in that band, and so we've crossed paths many times.
Yeah, it's a small community, you know, and especially because so many of us live in LA, you know, so you just tend to bump into each
other. But it's funny, though, because you were playing with Dio at the time, and you were playing with Ozzy.
Yeah.
That was kind of your first big gig, right? 86 or so? 87?
It's the one, yeah, that's the first gig that people know me for. I mean, I was doing a lot of stuff before then, but Ozzy was really the thing that broke me out on the scene, certainly in the rock world. Mm.
Was there because you would always hear stories about Dio and Ozzy getting kind of like a little bit of animosity. Did you guys ever see that? Did they ever cross paths?
Not on my watch. No, I never saw you know, Ronnie said a few things about Ozzy, mostly in jest, but no, I never happened to be in the room when the two of them
when that happened.
So I suppose there was a little bit of a, some sort of a friendly rivalry, you know. And two very, very different characters. I mean, you know, Ozzy is such a showman, and Ronnie was such a great technical singer, you know. Mm-hmm. But obviously, both served their time in Black Sabbath, so that was a big connection there.
Well, yeah, because Dio replaced Ozzy, right?
So yeah, never and we played some Sabbath songs. When we started on the Holy Diver tour in 1983, you know, we only had the Holy Diver album. There was only 9 songs on the album, so we needed to flesh out the show with other songs from Ronnie's career. So we played a couple of Rainbow songs, but we played Mob Rules and,
did you?
And Heaven and Hell. You know, obviously we didn't do Paranoid or anything.
None of that stuff,
from
right?
From Ozzy's era and stuff. But it was cool.
Oh, you were lucky.
I got to play being Tony Iommi and Richie Blackmore all in the same show.
Yeah. And not bad, too, because you're like probably, I don't know, you're 21 or 22 years old.
I was 21 when we started that tour.
And, yeah. And that's some pretty heavy, you know, shoes to fill with talking about Blackmore and Tony Iommi as well.
Well, it was great. We did different versions. We did real high-energy versions. Like we did Man on the Silver Mountain, and we did it like way faster than Rainbow ever did it, you know.
Yeah.
it was like almost like a punk ethos, you know. And Ronnie wanted that, and Vinny wanted it too. Vinny's just such a monster drummer. Vinny just wanted to kick the living shit out of it, you know. He's on the plane, that's too slow, you know. So we did pretty interesting versions, you know.
Honestly. And what Sabbath songs did you guys do in the Ozzy set and then the Ultimate Sin tour?
Well, we pretty much had to do Paranoid and Iron Man, which were the two anthems that we would do to, you know, towards the end of the set. Yeah, but when I joined the band, he did have quite a lot of legacy material from those first two albums, which, you know, were always the classic songs to the very day. So we would draw from a lot of that as well. But, you know, Ozzy never really liked to be too impulsive. I mean, he would pretty much like to have the set the way it was. And once we got through that set, we would go through it. So there wasn't much improvising.
Not a lot of changing around, right?
Not really, no, not really. But we only did the short version of Iron Man. We didn't, you know,
the fast part at the end.
Children of the Grave or anything like that.
Yeah.
And Paranoid, you know, and Crazy Train, of course.
Yeah.
Well, that's an Aussie tune.
That's the classics, anyway. Right?
So, yeah, I mean, that was a song. I never really enjoyed playing that song.
Crazy Train?
No, not
that. Why
is
that?
I don't know. It just seemed a bit twee to me. I mean, I don't know.
Tweed.
When I first time,
yes, twee. Yeah, you don't hear that one much.
Yeah, you don't. Right,
yeah. I think I heard Paul McCartney say it 5 years ago. That's about it.
But of all the songs, I mean, it's a great song. I'm not knocking it or anything like that. Mm. But it wasn't my favorite song of the set. So, but it was a song that we'd never do a show without playing that song, of course. And anytime somebody asks me to come jam, they say, "Hey, why don't you play Crazy Train?" And I'm thinking, okay.
All right, here we go. Did you play on the Ultimate Sin record?
Yes, I did.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. And how did you get that gig with Ozzy?
How? You know, really what it boiled down to was an audition. Mm-hmm. They were looking for another bass player after things had sort of not worked out well with Bob Daisley. My friend Randy Castillo had just got the gig playing drums, and Randy and I had been friends for a long time, but that wasn't the connection that got me in. I was friendly with Sharon and her management. It was a matter of time before they said, hey, you know, would you like to come down and audition? So I actually came down, played, did an audition, and I got the gig. They tried a whole bunch of other people out, and Sharon didn't think I was serious about it.
As far as?
I kept running into Ozzy, and he'd say, "Hey, why don't you come down and audition for the band? We're looking for a bass player." And I'd say, "Great, I'd love to come down." Then Sharon would call me the next day and say, "He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's drunk. He doesn't know what he's saying. Don't worry." And then one day, I was actually visiting a friend of mine in Brighton, and we were walking along the seafront, and I bump into this guy coming out of a joke shop, and it's Ozzy, and he's with Jimmy Ayres. Ozzy and Jimmy. And he says, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Visiting my friend here. What are you doing?" He's, "Well, we're auditioning bass players around the corner. Why don't you come down?" And I went down, I got the gig, and for months and months afterwards, he was convinced that I'd followed him all the way down to Brighton, and I was stalking him, which was absolutely not the truth.
The joke shop.
Yeah. So one day I said to him, he said, "You followed me down there, didn't you?" And I said, "No, I didn't." And finally I got fed up with it, and I said, "Well, would it have made any difference?" And he went, No, I guess not. I suppose not. And he never mentioned it again afterwards.
And it's for you, Viv, coming into the Dio camp, I mean, being just a kid, like you mentioned, a lot of pressure to fill these shoes as basically, you know, as an unknown guy, you know.
Yeah, it was quite surreal, you know. I literally was listening to the Heaven and Hell record. I'd only just gotten into Sabbath. When Ronnie joined Sabbath, that's when I became more interested in it. I wasn't so much of an Aussie fan. Mm-hmm. But when Ronnie joined the band, I became interested in Black Sabbath. And I was literally listening to the cassette in my car, because we're back in the 80s, right? Early 80s at that.
It was tough technology.
And that was like the album I was listening to at the time. And then at about 2 o'clock in the morning, that very same week, I got a call. Well, rather, my father got a call. My father's name was Vivian. And Jimmy Bain had looked up Vivian Campbell in the phone directory for Northern Ireland. And it's a small country, and there was only one Vivian Campbell. And he didn't know that was my father's name, but he just took a crapshoot, and he called it literally like 2 or 2.30 in the morning, woke my father up. I just remember my father came around, woke me up, and said, "There's a drunken Scotsman on the phone for you." And I went downstairs, and I took the call, and it was Jimmy. And Jimmy said, "Hey, Vav, it's Jammy Bain." And he says, "I'm here in a hotel room in London with Ronnie Dio and Vinnie Appice, and they're looking for a guitar player. Do you want to fly over tomorrow and audition?" And I had only met Jimmy through his band Wild Horses. He had a band called Wild Horses that did a couple of records on EMI. It was Jimmy and Brian Robertson, after Brian Robertson had left Thin Lizzy. And they'd come to Ireland, and my band, Sweet Savage, opened for them. We basically opened for every hard rock band that came through Ireland. And Jimmy had liked my playing, and he had remembered me. So he had looked me up at 2 o'clock in the morning when Ronnie had said, "Hey, do you know any guitar players?" So now, my father, the next morning, God bless him, I mean, he, despite having his sleep interrupted, he actually bought me the plane ticket, because I couldn't have afforded to fly to London. So he bought me the ticket. I flew over to London with my Les Paul, rented a Marshall. And Ronnie had written the song Holy Diver and had started to work on the song Don't Talk to Strangers. But that was it. That's all he had. And he showed me very basically. He just picked up Jimmy's bass and
He played bass, right?
Yeah. And showed me just the basic outline of it, and we started playing. And as soon as we started playing, Jimmy and Vinny and I, that was it. That was the instant sound of the early Dio records, and we all got goosebumps. It was so exciting. We just knew it was a magical moment, and the chemistry was right there, and we just played that song, and then we stopped, and then Ronnie rolled a few joints and got stoned.
A lot of people don't know that Dio was quite the pot.
He was a major pot guy. Yeah. I didn't smoke pot, but I was getting a contact high because I was in the room with him, because the rest of those guys were off their tits. but we played the song, and then Ronnie rolled a joint and they all got stoned. And like I say, I probably did indirectly. And then we played the song again, and it came time to play the guitar solo, and Ronnie just kept like giving me the motion, you know, the arm, just keep playing. And I ran out of licks, and because, you know, you're a guitar player, you got all your fancy chops, and you front load that, you know, you're okay, here's my best lick and here's my second best, and you do all the technical stuff. And I ran out of stuff to play after a while, and I started playing basic double stop standard Chuck Berry kind of rock and roll licks. And a couple of years later, Ronnie was recording all this. And a couple of years later, I was in Ronnie's house, and he found the cassette and he played the cassette. And he said, "There," he said, "that's when I knew you were the guy for me, when you started playing that stuff." So basically, when I ran out of ideas, was when he said, "Okay, that's my guy."
When you stopped thinking.
Exactly. It just proved, it became a very organic thing. That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I understand what he meant. I didn't get it at the time, but hearing it back, that's when I started having to be creative and thinking on my feet.
Right.
You know, and coming up with something to just fit the energy of the song, you know,
yeah.
Rather than just doing all my guitar wank, you know, because all us guitar players, we're all fret wankers, you know, we all just play too much. But so once I'd gotten that out of my system.
But especially at that time frame in the early 80s, the faster you played, the cooler you were.
Exactly. And that, you know, being a 20-year-old, which I was when I auditioned for the band, that's what I was thinking. I'm thinking I've got to be as technical as possible. But I came to realize when I came here to LA, and I realized that there were so many great technical guitar players in this city, Ronnie didn't just want that. It's got to go beyond just the technique, mm-hmm. you know, which is going back to the Chuck Berry licks, you right. know. It's sometimes it's
not what you play, it's what you don't play.
Exactly. Right. And it's being forced to think on your feet and to be creative, you know. Mm-hmm. He was looking for something different than what he could find here in L.A. Whereas, ironically, as soon as I got to L.A., I wanted a Charvel guitar with a Floyd Rose and a rack full of gear, which if I'd had that, Ronnie would never have hired me, you know, because he got that a dime a dozen in L.A. Right. But being in Belfast back then, I mean, we didn't have Guitar Center. Yeah, I couldn't get a Floyd Rose guitar. I'd heard Eddie Van Halen and shit my pants, mm-hmm. you know, say, oh, I've got to get a tremolo bar that actually doesn't put your guitar out of tune. Right. I want one of those, you know. And all this great gear that I'd be reading about in guitar magazines that I couldn't afford. But less is more, you know. And mm-hmm. I've actually come full circle with that. I mean, like in Last in Line, when we go out and play, I play my Les Paul and there's a cable and it goes straight into the amp. And that's it. There's nothing. Yeah. You know, sometimes I use a wah-wah, but even then that's like a...
Because that's the true secret of guitar playing. It's like, how do you get your tone? It's in your hands.
It's in your hands.
You, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, that's what it is.
It's so refreshing as well. I mean, I just love... I love the sound that Viv gets. And I remember looking the first time we were playing. And I think I asked you, I said, do you have any pedals or anything? Do you use anything? He said, well, I have that wah-wah pedal that I use on one song or something. And it was straight in. But I have a story about that. Because when we had to try to find another guitar player after Jake left the Ozzy's band, and we went through 400 guitar players, Randy Castillo and myself. Ozzy took off and went to promote the tribute album, I think, and left us here in L.A., and we went through 400 people. We didn't play with 400. We went through their tapes and everything else, and we got it down to probably about 60 or 70 people that actually made it down and actually came in and played, and it was at the time when GIT had become like a really big thing. And every single person that came in, just as Viv's describing, had that Charvel guitar mm-hmm. with a rack of equipment and a tech, and it took them about 45 minutes to set up, and they'd set up and they'd play, and it was exactly the same sound, exactly the same licks, and that sound was so saturated, which means it's sort of distorted, and sometimes I mix records as well for people, and you get that sound, and it's the only way I can describe it is if you've got your hand on the fader of the guitar, over here, you can't hear it, and over here it's all you can hear. Mm-hmm. There's just there's no transients, there's no dynamics, doesn't step out, mm-hmm. and in the midst of this, Zach comes in, he flies in, and he comes in with a very very unfashionable Les Paul, and mm-hmm. we said, do you have your equipment? Do you have any? No, I don't have anything. Do you have an amp I can use? And there's this sad, lonely Marshall 4x12 that no one has plugged in because they're all playing through, you know, whatever, the Randalls or whatever people were using back then. And he turned around, plugged it in, literally did the same thing, plugged the Les Paul into the amp and played. And for the first time, the air in that studio started to move. Mm. And it worked with what Randy and I was doing. And it was like a breath of fresh air. It was fantastic. Mm. All of a sudden, it was the most powerful sound. And we knew straight away.
I didn't realize that you were there when Zach was auditioning. Zach was playing, right? Because it was the Noise for the Wicked right after that. But you weren't on that record.
No, we actually got Zach in the band. We worked a lot together. We did a few shows together, and then after that, I'd been writing a lot of that record, and for whatever reason, I couldn't come to a publishing arrangement with Sharon, and I decided to move on.
Sure, but that seems to be the thing both with Dio and Ozzy's case was that you would come in the band and write tunes, and then. That's basically your job, and they would keep the publishing of them or whatever it would be.
I'm not paying your dues.
Yeah, well, that's it though, right? Because I know Jake told the same story, like you said, part of paying your dues, which is funny because and you know, it's one of those things, and now you guys will understand, you know, being in the band that you're in, owning the band, that sort of thing. I remember when Sting left the Police, and there's a documentary about him putting together the Dream of the Blue Turtles record. It's called Bring on the Night. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about Miles Copeland is the manager, and he's talking. He's a very fast talker, and he's like, I guess they had Branford Marsalis or Winford, all these jazz guys. Yeah. And then when the band started rolling, of course they wanted some cash, and Miles was like, listen, they're saying there's more money on the table. Guess what? It's Sting's table. You know, we do Madison Square Garden, and Winford Marsalis on the show. There's no refunds. Sting's on the show. Everyone wants their money back. So you know, you can kind of understand, even though it's hard, and it's a team, and both those band, those yeah. lineups you guys were in were great lineups, but yeah. you know, now.
But I think, you know, when you're involved in the creative process, when you're writing the songs, mm-hmm. you know,
it's a different story.
It's a different story. And you know, I'm not familiar exactly with Phil's story with Ozzy, but I mean, in the Dio days, like I said, when we went in to do the Holy Diver record, Ronnie had written the title track and he was working on Don't Talk to Strangers, and the other seven songs in the record we wrote collectively mm-hmm. here in LA. And the same for the Last in Line album, you know, and the Sacred Heart album. They were very, very much...
It's a band effort.
A band effort. And that's what Ronnie wanted, ironically. You know, that first night when I auditioned with the band in London, that's what Ronnie told us. You know, he said he'd left Sabbath. He had an existing solo deal. We were going to call the band Dio, obviously, because for name recognition, nobody's going to call it Campbell, you know, or being a rapacy. So, and it made perfect sense. He said, it's going to be, you're going to work on a wage, but we're going to create together as a band. And he says, if this is successful, by the third album, we'll make it an equity situation. And that's why I got fired, because I was the first one to hold my hand up and say, Ronnie, we've done the third album. Do you remember that night in London? And they just kept pushing it off. And he said, oh, we'll talk about it when Wendy gets here. And in hindsight, I now realize that Ronnie never shared his initial vision with his ex-wife, Wendy, who was managing the band, you know, and she had a whole different idea. She wanted Ronnie to be the solo artist. She didn't see the value in what Ronnie saw in the unit being a creative unit.
Sure.
You know, she just didn't get that. You know, she just thought it was Ronnie and whoever.
Get
a bunch of guys on stage, it doesn't matter. Well, guess what? It does matter. It makes a big difference.
It does, and it's funny because you think about, even with like the David Lee Roth band with Steve Vai and Billy Sheehan, the first record, Eat 'Em and Smile, it's incredible. One of the best party rock technical playing records you'll ever hear. I think it was the same vibe, and the second record comes, Billy leaves, and then suddenly it starts going downhill. That happened with Dio as well, and this is like nothing bad, but as a fan, the first three Dio records had steam and had power, and just what a great lineup and what a great sound. As soon as the Night People record, Dream Evil, there was a difference.
Well, that's what comes down to the word that was mentioned before, which is the chemistry.
Right.
Yeah. Chemistry. When you get that chemistry in and you change one little element, there's a chance that the whole thing will disappear.
You can mess up the whole band.
Yeah. I am a firm believer that each and every one of us is unique, like your fingerprints. You know, we all bring something different to the table. Like, no two guitar players ever play exactly the same. No two singers the same. No two drummers or bass players. It's the timing, the feel, the dynamic, the angle of attack on the pick, you know, your vibrato, your phrasing, your tone. Like we were saying earlier, it's in your fingertips. So every musician is unique, and you find the right combination of people to play with, and that creates a unique sound of a band. And you know, it's never the same when you start pulling elements out of it. It never can be, you know. You can always just find the closest thing to that, but it's never going to be quite the same, you know. And you look at a band like AC/DC nowadays, you know, I mean, it's just Angus is in the band. And from what I'm hearing, next time they tour, that'll be about it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's at what point does it cease to be AC/DC?
Mm-hmm.
So now I understand that the music is what really outlives all of us, you know. When people come to see any rock show, they're there because of the music that band has written and recorded and created. That's timeless, you know. But there's also a lot to be said for the integrity of a lineup of a band, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, Viv, just talking about that, and you're talking about when Steve Clark passes away and you come in to play with Def Leppard. How hard was that for you to come into a band where those five guys have been a gang, and now, from what I understand, in a pretty integral part of the songwriting process and kind of the chemistry, obviously, of the band, and here you come.
It was actually easier for me than it was for them.
For them.
Because, you know, ever since day one with Def Leppard, every time the Joe or Sav or Rick or Phil or even Pete Willis back in the day, anytime that they had looked to their right, it would have been Steve Clark on stage right, and all of a sudden it wasn't. It was someone else. So at that stage, I'd been in Dio, I'd been in Whitesnake, I'd done a spell with a band called River Dogs, I'd done a record with Lou Gramm, but I was used to coming into a situation and making it work. So it was a little bit easier for me to walk into that band. Plus, I was a huge Def Leppard fan. I was very, very familiar with the music. Going back to before the first album, I mean, I had the early singles.
The EP,
I remember buying Wasted in the Picture Sleeve and stuff. So I genuinely was a big fan. I was very, very familiar with it. But there was no way in hell I was going to sound like Steve. I can't, you know. But you know what the band, it was a great loss for Def Leppard with Steve, because Steve was also, having been with Leppard for almost 25 years now, I know that he was the big writer guy. He was the riff guy.
Really?
You know? Yeah. So I do feel that's a loss, because when I write a riff for Def Leppard, my natural tendency is to write heavy, you know. So, and it's not always going to fit the Def Leppard formula. Template, so, yeah. So it's a different kind of thing, you know. Steve and I are not at all similar guitar players, you know. But I've really learned to appreciate what it was that he brought to Def Leppard. I mean, not that I didn't beforehand, but I mean, it really, I've gotten to live in his skin, if you want to say, for like 24, 25 years. And I've really gotten to get very, very intimate with his music.
Because I'm sure that was a huge audition process too, because I'd actually heard rumors here and there that there was three major name guys that were up for that gig.
Yeah, it wasn't an audition. It was more a courtship.
Sure,
you know, it's more about the personality and work. And like when you're in a band with people, we call it submarine duty, you know, because you're on a tour bus
totally
18 hours a day or whatever. So, you know, you kind of have to get along. So the process took a month or two and involved getting together and playing, and that was easy enough. I mean, they knew I could play guitar. What they didn't know when I joined the band was that I can actually sing.
Right.
And that was a big plus.
So important for them.
Because Steve actually didn't, apparently.
Oh.
Steve used to pretend to sing. So, you know, that was, I guess, a plus for Joe and the other guys in the band. And but it was, we'd get together and we'd play, and then we'd go to dinner, and then we'd play soccer on a Sunday afternoon. We even went to the IMAX theater to see Rolling Stones movie, you know. It was stuff like that. And then we'd go back a week later to the rehearsal room and play. It was getting to know each other, because Joe was the only one that I knew prior to joining the band, you know. And I'd had, I guess, a bit of a reputation, because I'd been in Dio, I'd gotten fired, I'd been in Whitesnake for about 20 minutes, you know. So they wanted to make sure that it was going to work, you know. So that's what that was about.
How was it for you, Phil, when you came into the Aussie camp? I mean, you said you knew Randy, but what was it like with Jake playing with him? He's another great player.
Well, you know, I wasn't, who was I replacing? I wasn't replacing them. I was replacing Bob Daisley.
Right, yeah.
So, there's been a very back and forth relationship between Bob and the Aussie camp. And again, it sort of stems from a sort of writing issue. And, by the way, I mean, on the subject of that, you know, if I'm writing something for someone like Ozzy, I wouldn't begrudge participating in that with them, because they, you know, they honestly, they are going to put a lot of money and a lot of effort into creating that, taking that song and marketing it for me. If I was making a shirt, they're going to go and do the production and, you know, get it out there, and made the song a very big hit. I think it became a problem where they sort of expected, there wasn't a lot of a community writing thing, and they expected songs to come in, and then they sort of expected to not participate or share them, but they really wanted to keep
control of it.
All of it.
Yeah.
So that was my sort of issue with it.
Because you wrote Shot in the Dark, right?
Mm-hmm,
yeah. That's I know you have a credit on that. Yeah.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, we changed, came up with a few different parts for that song. So Ozzy did have some participation in it. He's not completely, you know,
just sitting there,
right? But when I first came in after Bob, I didn't have any strange, you know, it wasn't difficult for me at all. I had my friend Randy playing drums, and Randy and I were so tight as friends, as well as players. We played really well together, and we connected, and we'd known each other already for about 4 years or so. So that was very easy. Ozzy was just happy. You know, he was happy to hear a band that was really doing well and playing well together. Jake is a strange guy. He's very quiet, kind of keeps to himself.
Quirky guy.
Took a long, long time to really even get to know him. I mean, he's not a conversational type of person. You can't really converse with him. You can't speak with him. You know, he's like one-word answers. Mm-hmm. And he's not malicious. It's just the way
he is.
So that was probably the most awkward thing. Going out and playing in front of fans, I mean, I felt a certain amount of humility, because I was not just expecting to be accepted by every fan just because I'm standing on that stage. Mm-hmm. So I was always very humble about that, and thinking, well, if people actually like me, then I've earned that. But
right.
But that was what the experience was like for me.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Last in Line, Viv, and it's interesting because you mentioned, you know, leaving Ronnie, getting fired in 86, and not playing those songs for 25 years or so.
Not play. I didn't even listen to them. I didn't know the record.
Which, just, now, once again, as a fan, I'm like, yeah, I would go see you at Def Leppard. Always great singing, but it's a different style of playing guitar, unless you're doing Wasted or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, which we don't do very often.
Right.
Yeah, the challenge in Leppard is the vocal.
Sure,
that's, you know, that's where I really have
guitar
to
guitar-wise, recording, and you're playing a couple leads, but it's more of the singing. But wow, yeah. Like Vivian Campbell, the ripping Vivian Campbell, you didn't do that for a long time. And mm-hmm. what prompted you to finally decide to get back with those great tunes?
Well, like I say, I didn't even own the records or want anything to do with that for the longest time, because it did leave such a bad taste mm-hmm. in my mouth. The way that things went down, like I said, you know, Ronnie from day one had promised us that by the third album, it would be an equitable situation. And we actually, a lot of people don't understand, it's not about money, it's about principle.
Of course it is.
Very, very big on principle.
Dude, I agree. I hear you.
And we were out there playing arenas around the world, playing songs that we wrote with Ronnie, and earning less than our road crew. There were certain people on our crew who were getting paid more than the band. You know, and I just, after a while, that's just wrong. So I was very big on the principle, and I was the first one, because I had the least to lose. Back then, I wasn't married or anything, didn't have any kids. You know, I was just young and reckless. And so I went to Ronnie, and I said, Ronnie, you promised us this. When are we going to discuss this? And like I said, they kept pushing off, and then eventually Wendy fired me. So it left such a bad taste in my mouth, because I had invested so much emotionally into that band, into those records, those songs. And just,
it was your band.
It was
our
my
band.
Yeah, it was my life. I felt part of the team. I was definitely part of the creative team, and to just be dismissed like that left me feeling so hurt. I wanted nothing to do with it for years. And then, you know, with the passage of all this time, you know, time changes your perception, you know, and things happened. And I think it's also, you know, Ronnie passed away in 2010. And I think once Ronnie had passed away, I was able to look at it in a different way, you know. Well, a couple of things happened. Around the time, right after Ronnie passed away, I got a call from Scott Gorham from Thin Lizzy asking if I wanted to be a stunt guitarist on a Thin Lizzy tour in Europe, because Leppard were working that year. And Thin Lizzy were so important to me when I was a teenager, before I was in Dio, when I was really honing my craft. Lizzy were the band for me. Scott Gorham, Brian Robertson, but in particular, Gary Moore. Gary was the guy I emulated the most.
Another Irish guy.
Yeah. So to be on stage with Scott Gorham and Brian Downey, playing Jailbreak, playing Black Rose, playing Emerald, playing the songs of my youth, really reignited my passion for guitar playing again. And so I came off of that tour, and I called Vinny Appice, I called Jimmy Bean. I said, do you want to get together and just play in a room? Like, no agenda. That's all it was. I just wanted to play guitar, and that's what we did. So we started playing. And at that stage, that was around the middle of 2011. Ronnie had passed away a year before. And it had been about 27 years since I'd played with those guys. And as soon as we started playing, it was just like that first night in London in 1982. It was absolutely instantaneous. It was
the chemistry.
The chemistry hadn't gone away at all. And I got so excited, and we all got so excited, and we all just played and played and played, and we were laughing and smiling. And it was just such a joyous thing. And it made me realize that this was as much my music as it was Ronnie's, that I'd shut it out for so many years because of the hurt. And it's my heritage as much as it was Jimmy's and Vinny's and Ronnie's. And so I just really started to embrace it. And I also really started to reconnect with my guitar again. Mm-hmm. It had been a long, long time since I'd had to challenge myself to play like that. So one thing led to another. We went out and we did some gigs just playing songs from the first three albums that we were involved with Ronnie. We decided to call it Last in Line. I just kind of blurted it out. Hey, you want to do some gigs? Let's go out and call it Last in Line, because, you know, Ronnie had passed away. We are the last in line. Mm-hmm. You know, we're the last ones there. So, and we had no real agenda, just other than to play a couple of local shows. And that's when we met Andrew. Vinny introduced us to Andrew Freeman. And when Andy came in, that's when I had the idea to go do some shows, because Andy didn't sound anything like Ronnie, but he's a very powerful and passionate singer who could do justice to the songs, but he didn't have that tonality of Ronnie. If Andy had walked into the room and sounded like a Ronnie clone, I would never have wanted to do it. It just would have been wrong. But also the fact, like I said, that Ronnie had passed away really kind of cast all of this in a different light. And I said, this is our heritage as much as it was his, mm-hmm. you know, and I think Ronnie would actually approve. Mm. You know, I think Ronnie is up there somewhere smiling down on us, you know. I think
did you ever have a chance to talk to him before he passed away?
No, we never saw each
never
other again.
We
made the mistake of talking to each other in the press, you know, and that never works out well. I said some very mean things about Ronnie, and he said some very mean things about me, you know, and I know that if he were sitting at this table here today, we'd be good.
It would take a 10-minute conversation just to get the
Get
the shit out of the way and get
absolutely.
Going. Yeah.
But we would have been good. I mean, Ronnie and I never had a great relationship. Personally, at times we did, but it was a bit like being in a band with your dad, to be honest, because he was that much older than me.
Sure, right.
Know? When I started, I was a kid, and it was so... To correct that, it's a bit like being in a band with your stepfather. We had this very strange kind of relationship, and I was very respectful, but also very fearful of him because he was a hero to me. I mean, I was listening to Mob Rules and Heaven and Hell literally the week before I fly to London to audition for this band. So it was a very surreal experience to be with Ronnie, and I actually lived in the house with him for many, many months too. So, you know, and I'd say, oh, Ronnie, I'm just going to head out now, and what time are you going to be back? Do you have a key?
You know, I've got to leave. Dio's going to kill me if it's 4 in the morning. So,
it was quite bizarre, but we had a difficult kind of relationship, but it definitely worked musically. You know,
it sure
absolutely.
Did. Do you feel that this is almost kind of in a way like a homage and a tribute to Ronnie to do this to kind of
absolutely,
keep that style alive?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
is, yep.
I kind of
we're celebrating this music, you know. And like I said, we're not. It would have been tacky and cheap to go out with a Ronnie clone.
Sure,
you know, and I didn't want to do anything.
You guys
like that.
Almost did what DC did after Bon Scott passed away, and getting a Brian Johnson who can sing those songs, but it's a completely different style of singer.
Yeah, right. You know, a lot of people have said to me since, you know, like, why don't you get so and so or so and so? You know, this guy sounds just like Ronnie.
Yeah.
That's totally missing the point. You know, Ronnie was the best of his genre, and anything else is going to be a cheap second.
Right,
so
right.
Andy can do justice to these songs in a different way. You know, he brings his own style to it.
Yeah. Were you a Dio fan, Phil?
Of course. I mean, through the Black Sabbath connection, of course. And in a way, I kind of see Dio and Ozzy as being, you know, I think I call them sister bands.
Absolutely.
You know?
No doubt about it.
And so we always, you know, whenever we came across each other, there was a certain... respect and also a certain amount of common ground that was already, you know, pre-established. And so and you know, even with Jimmy, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a moment, but you know, one of the things, just to touch on what Viv was saying, I think a lot of people might suggest that they should have found a singer that sounds like Ronnie Dio, because then it would be authentic. When you look at a lot of bands now, all they're doing is going out and playing their hits from the past. And one of the things that I find so exciting about this band is that this is definitely part of the agenda, but that the new record that they did stands up so much on
its
own. And even the few shows that we've done, I can see the response from the audience. They're really keen to hear this new material. And that's a very rare and precious thing now. And having someone like Andrew singing there and bringing a completely different flavor to it, I think it's just fantastic. It's just a really great
well, in a way too, it's almost what Thin Lizzy did when you played with them, having dude singing with them right now. I can't remember his name for Thin Lizzy.
Oh, Ricky Warwick.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it's not a Phil in it clone.
Yeah,
but they're also doing new material. So the band, because you can't go out there and just do your songs from the first three records, that'd probably get pretty crazy after a while. But to have new material and then throw in the kind of sprinkle in the classics, I'm sure that's a lot of fun.
Well, with us, with Last in Line, this all happened, like I said, very organically. It wasn't like we had a 10-year plan. Let's start doing this and let's do that. You know, we just started playing shows for fun. One thing led to another. We went to the UK a couple of years ago, did some shows. We went to Japan, did the Loud Park Festival in 2013. And it was basically right after that that Frontiers Records got in touch and said, would you be interested in writing and recording an album of new material? And we honestly hadn't thought of it that far. But when somebody's actually offering you the opportunity to do that, we decided to do it. So that's what we went into the studio and we started writing. And it just fell out of us. The only agenda we had going to write that record was that we wanted to approach it the same way that we approached the Holy Diver record. And that's Jimmy and Vinny and myself in a room just kicking around ideas. And that's how it started. And so we wrote and recorded three or four songs, and then a couple of months later we did the same thing over a period of a week or so, and then again. So it was like three different installments over four or five or 6 months or whatever. But there is a certain sound to it. There was a sound that, like I said, when Jimmy and Vinny and I played together, that was the sound of the early Dio records. But that wasn't a preconceived notion of ours. That wasn't something we engineered. That's just what happens when we play
together.
It's
the chemistry.
Yeah, it is the chemistry. So that's why the record sounds exciting in that way. It sounds like the early Dio records because it's, guess what? It's the guys
it's the same dude
who did the early Dio records.
You know, it's funny. You know the producer, heard the name Andy Sneap? He's a pretty big-time metal producer guy. And he went and saw you guys at one of your early shows. He lives in Nottingham, wherever, somewhere near where you were. Wow. And he sent me a video of whatever song it was. And he said, you know what? He said, bands don't play like this anymore. Yeah. He said, it makes you realize how great this band is playing with all these other bands. Because this is a band.
Yeah.
The sound, the power, the chemistry. And Andy's a musical snob.
Yeah,
if it sucked, he would have said, they suck.
But I'm very flattered, yeah. I mean, there's a real energy. When you play with Vinny Appice, you have to play on a level. Vinny is the loudest drummer I've ever played with. And I've played with a lot of great drummers. Yeah. Vinny is... To me, he's so inspiring. I get so inspired when Vinny plays. Like, even when we were writing and I show up with nothing, which happens a lot. So I show up, I got no ideas. I'm thinking, shit, I hope Jimmy has some good ideas. Like, I got nothing to bring to the party. Vinny starts playing a beat and I'm instantly inspired. I'll find something to play on time.
Right.
He lights my fire that way, you know? So it's a real joy to play with him. But you've got to bring your A game when you play with Vinny.
Sure.
I mean, you got to be on it because he, as Phil will tell you, he goes off on some weird tangents, you know, just like out of nowhere, he'll take you on some diversion, and you gotta be on your toes to keep up.
How was it for you to start playing with Vinny Appice?
Well, we've actually been playing together in a celebrity band that we have called Big Noise since 2005 or 2006.
Ah,
so I've gotten used to what some of the things that Vinny will do, and we have a lot of fun with it. I've got some. I've been privileged to play with some truly remarkable drummers and some great people. Everyone from, you know, Greg Bissonette, Simon Phillips. I've done a lot of work with I worked with Steve Lukather a lot. So things that were kind of veering onto the sort of jazz rock type of genre. So I'm fairly adept at dealing with complex timings and complex rhythms, and Vinny loves to do stuff like that. So he'll take off and go off on a completely different polyrhythm. And if you don't know where you are, you can't hold your own, you're lost. You're finished. And so I actually really, really enjoy playing with Vinny for that reason. I don't know where he's going to go, and when he does go somewhere,
it keeps you on your toes as a musician.
Keeps you on your toes.
Right?
And then when you make these things work, sometimes I just look at him and I know I can see what he's going to do. And we'll play together. And then when that comes out, when that gels... It's just a fantastic elation.
I mean,
the two of us look at each other and we just like laugh.
We did it.
We did it.
All right, Vivian Campbell and Phil Sussan from Last in Line are sitting here with me now. Vivian, how was it for you playing those solos that you played on the Dio records now compared to when you were 21?
Were they hard?
Oh, very, very, very. I had to really do a lot of homework to get back up to speed on that. And the other thing is, I couldn't change it. Like back in Dio days, I used to not always play the same stuff, but you could get away with it when it's fresh. But those records have been around for decades now, literally 30 years for 33 or something. So the solos, for anyone who's familiar with the record, when they come to see Last in Line, they're going to want to hear pretty much note for note. So I wanted to be as accurate as possible and as authentic as possible to the original recording. So I really had to go back and learn how to do it. I actually went on YouTube and watched other people. You know how you have these videos on YouTube and you don't even see who the person
right,
is.
Right.
You just see the guitar and the hands, you know,
kid or something.
So someone in their bedroom playing along to the record. So I went on YouTube for certain things like the solo in Rainbow in the Dark. Cause I couldn't remember. There were certain parts where I think, did I play it here or did I do this inversion? And I couldn't quite remember some of them. So I went on YouTube and most of them were like, horrendously wrong, you know. No, that's shit. And then I found one guy. I have no idea who he was because, like I say, you couldn't even see his face, but I could see he was playing a Les Paul, I think. And I said, oh yeah, that's it. That's exactly how I did it. So thank you,
whoever
obscure
you are,
guy on YouTube.
Some guy playing a Les Paul.
Yeah, for helping me reconnect with my original solos. But the another thing is though too, I had no appreciation for what I was doing back then. I used to be so insecure as a guitarist because of all these GIT Hollywood guys who were just monster technicians. And I've never had that technique. I can't do the alternate picking or sweep arpeggios or any of that stuff. I always was so frustrated in the 80s. I wanted to play like Yngwie and like Paul Gilbert and all these great players and George Lynch, but I didn't have the technique for that. And so I was really down on my playing, you know, like I just didn't have any confidence. But with this passage of time and going back and relearning my solos from 30-something years ago, I have a new appreciation for them. I can say, okay, that's why Ronnie wanted me to play guitar in his band. But back then, I didn't get it.
Which is so incredible because, like I said, like Vivian Campbell as a kid, being it's like Vivian Campbell, he's right up there with Randy Rhoads or whoever, like the theater that you kind of didn't know for sure.
I didn't feel that at all.
Dude, no, yeah, we all were. You guys never came to Winnipeg. That's from Winnipeg. Dio never came to Winnipeg, Canada, so I never got to see you play those songs live. Yeah. So did you ever, playing Jimmy's stuff, was it hard? Because once again, the rock solid on bass, on the rhythms.
Well, Jimmy and I had been friends from a long time. I was good friends with Brian Robertson, who was, as Viv had said, was a guitar player in Wild Horses. And he introduced me to Jimmy back in London when I was living in London, and this was probably 81 or something.
Right.
You know, and Jimmy and I got on really well. I was much more friendly with Brian. But then when I came over here in 84 or 85, whenever it was, the first night I went out, I ran into Jimmy Bain. He said, oh, yeah, remember we met? Yeah, Robbo's friend, this and that. Well, I got a house out here. If you want to come and stay, man, you can come and stay at the house. So
that's a good Jimmy accent, by the way.
That's not bad,
that's
right?
Pretty close.
I had a little bit of experience with him, and then I'd see him loads, you know, many, many times. And then one day I came out here and I took him up on it. And I went up to the house and I just kind of moved in. I didn't really move in, but I just never left. And so the two of us were living up there and we did everything together. We had a great time. So, amongst other things, you know, we would sit there and jam together as well. He had gotten all of this Yamaha equipment. I think as a result of Jimmy Bain, Yamaha doesn't give any equipment to anybody anymore because he'd gotten so much stuff from he'd gotten golf clubs from the golf cart and God knows what else. And he'd set all this stuff up in his garage and it was a wall of Yamaha amps and all of this stuff. And he had it all connected up. And if you went in there and played, it was just really loud.
Loud, yeah.
But we'd go in there and we'd jam all the time. And I was kind of playing double bass with him all the time. We were doing this stuff and we were just trading licks around.
I think Phil is probably the closest you could say to Jimmy.
I was going
to
say, you're almost like a better-looking version of Jimmy, too.
I used to tell him that all the time.
There's a similarity there, like his little brother or something, exactly. You know?
But I think, you know, because of Phil's background playing with Ozzy, you know, playing that kind of music and almost a parallel existence coming up with Ozzy while we were playing with Ronnie, it's an innate sort of a thing. You know, he very much plays in the style that Jimmy did, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, no two people ever play alike.
Sure.
But Phil really, I think, understands the DNA of this music.
Yeah. And that aside as well, I was also a big fan of Jimmy's, you know, the Rainbow album and stuff. Absolutely. Absolutely. He was a great, great bass player.
I think probably one of the most underrated bass players.
Absolutely. Yeah, people don't realize it. I mean, people think, oh, he's just the bass player guy, but... There's a hell of a lot to it.
I mean, he's as powerful, and on those Dio tracks, he's as powerful as Vinny is playing the drums. I mean, you can't have a drummer that's that big and then bring in somebody that's sort of tucked around in the back.
Sure,
it's got to be somebody who can hold their own and be as powerful. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy was absolutely that.
And he also one of the a true rock and roll character as well.
Oh, jeez, yeah. You know? I mean, there's stories I could tell you about Jimmy. I mean, he was Mr. Rock and Roll. Yeah. Jimmy and I shared three different Oakwood apartments while we were making records over the years. And believe me, that was quite the experience. Back in the 80s, to be a roommate with Jimmy Bain.
He's one of those guys that looked old even when he was young.
Yeah.
You see certain guys like that, right?
Jimmy, you know, he partied hard. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a real deal. He lived the rock and roll lifestyle, you know.
I vaguely know the story because I heard you tell it, but I was there a time when the cops came looking for him and he hid in a road case or something?
Yeah.
Can you tell that story?
I think it was Kansas City. We were in a bar. We had a night off before the show in Kansas, and Jimmy and I were in a bar, and he got into it with someone, and he hit someone.
Mm-hmm.
And they went and filed charges, and we heard after the show the following night, we heard the police were here for Jimmy. So we were in the dressing room. So we put him in the wardrobe case and wheeled the case right past the cops. And they're, James Bane. And they were knocking on the door. Is there a James Bane? Oh, you just left. You just missed him. You know, we'll see if we can find him. And Jimmy's in the back of the truck. So
yeah,
he had to wait there till the cops left. But
back in those days, that's all it took. If you just get out of the building.
Yeah, if you got out of Dodge, you're all right. Yeah.
You're okay.
I think he stayed in that road case until about 1989, probably.
Yeah. And then Vinny was saying, like, you know, when we heard the cops coming, he said to Ronnie, don't announce us tonight. You know, don't kind of point out who's in the band kind of thing, you know.
On bass.
Don't make it easy for me. Yeah.
So how was it? I mean, not how was it, but it's just a crazy story. You reunite after all these years, and then you go do the Def Leppard cruise, and here Jimmy passes away on the cruise.
Yeah, it was a month before the Heavy Crown album was released.
Before the album was even released.
Yeah, so a month before the records come out, we had a tour booked for right after the Leppard cruise, and the Leppard cruise was going to be the first thing we did. Mm-hmm. And then off the back of that, a few weeks later, we were going to start this
So you're debuting the new line.
The new album, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Album, yeah. So it was just the worst timing. But, you know, it's been such a tragic blow to lose Jimmy because Jimmy was a friend of mine. I mean, I'd known him for so long. And if it wasn't for Jimmy, I would never have been in the Dio band. You know, he was the one who, like I said, called my dad at 2 in the morning. Yeah. And recommended me to Ronnie and stuff. So I feel like I really owed Jimmy so much, you know. And like I said, we were roommates for so long. And it was just really, really sad, you know. And Jimmy believed in this record and this band so much. Something that really bothered me right after Jimmy died was a lot of people in the press just immediately jumped to the conclusion that his death was substance related, you know, because he did have a bit of a history with that. But I was at pains to point out that for the last 2 years of Jimmy's life, he was sober. And in fact, when we were writing the album, Jimmy was in a halfway house. And he couldn't get out before 4 p.m. and he had to be in by 10. And I'd go around, it was in Hollywood, a horrible little place. And I'd go around and pick him up at 4:15, would go to the rehearsal room, meet up with Vinny, get some ideas together. And then I'd take him back before 10 o'clock and drop. And, you know, so Jimmy was, this band and this record was the only thing that Jimmy really had in his life to focus on. And he was focused on it intently. And that was his beacon of light. Mm-hmm. That was his salvation. In the last couple of years of his life, he believed in this project so much. He was so excited to be doing this. And that's why he should never have gone on that cruise. I mean,
really?
Well, we didn't know he had cancer. I mean, I don't know if Jimmy did either, but we knew he had pneumonia. You know, he'd been diagnosed as having pneumonia and he was taking antibiotics for it. And he was not well, but Jimmy insisted on doing it. He wanted to do it. You know, I always say this about him. He was a true rock and roller to the end, and he died with his boots on, you know, literally. I mean, we literally found him in full regalia in his cabin on that ship, you know, and he was living it to the end, you know, and he believed in us so much, and it was so sad that he never got to actually see it. You know, for a while, we canceled that tour that we were going to do, and then, you know, Vinny and Andy and I talked about it, and we realized that we owed it to Jimmy, because Jimmy had helped us make such a great record that we owed it to do something with it. Mm-hmm. We owed it to Jimmy. So that's why we started looking around. We were very fortunate to get Phil to come in and Eric Norlander on keys, and we went out and we did some shows. And
as a quick segue to you, listen, we all have to go at some point. To go on a cruise ship after playing a gig wearing your rock and roll clothes, I can think of worse ways.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he was in the Caribbean. He did all right. Yeah.
So he had cancer. I didn't even know that.
None of us knew.
You said he might not even have known.
I suspect Jimmy had to know something was going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can't have lung cancer that bad and
lung
not
cancer.
Know that gotcha. Something's happening.
Right.
But Jimmy would have been the kind of guy that wouldn't have told you. You know, he wouldn't have said anything about it. He was never a complainer. The other thing about Jimmy was, you know, he would never have done anything about it. He's also the kind of guy, he would never have gone to a doctor and said, you know, help me add some years to my life. Jimmy just would have said, fuck it.
I think Lemmy was the same. Lemmy found out he had cancer and died the next day. I think he was like, oh, I'm just going to take myself out.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
This is, I'm not going
there's a certain mentality. And I do think that Lemmy, what I know about Lemmy and what I know about Jimmy, that they were very much similar characters.
That's true, right?
So
how did you get the call to come join the band, Phil?
Well, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably due to my friendship with Vinny. And also I was doing the Reigning the Rock Vault show with Andrew.
In
Vegas. Been doing that for quite some time.
Okay.
And I think it's probably something, you know, somehow through those two. There. Yeah. You know, I got a call from Vinny, and he said, would you be interested in coming down and playing? You know, we're going to see if we want to carry the, you know, carry on doing what we're doing. And I said, of course, I'd love to, you know.
And yeah, when Phil came in and played, we knew right away that he was the right guy for us. It, in so many ways, the playing, his personality, and the fact that he can sing too, because Jimmy was a great singer, and, and we needed. I don't want to sing in Last in Line. I get enough of that in my day job. I just want to play guitar.
Yeah.
So, and that way, I was, you know, I could. Andy will say to me, well, why don't you sing the BVS? I just don't want to. I don't want to sing in Last. I just want to play guitar. So when Phil walked in, it was instant. We knew that he was.
But once again, we were talking about Def Leppard earlier, those guys never playing those songs without Steve Clark. You had never played those Dio songs without Jimmy Bain. That's Vinny had played them with other guys, but and Jimmy had too, but you never had.
Yeah, well, there's a certain quality. You know, we played with a few guys, and one or two of them were actually exceptionally good, but they just didn't have quite the right style. Mm-hmm. When Phil walked in, like I said, it's that DNA thing, and I think it goes back to his playing with Ozzy, playing that kind of music. You know, he knows how to keep up with us, because you really, like I said, but you got to bring your A game when you play with Vinny,
right?
You know, so there's not many that can really do it
hone in the way on that Jimmy did,
right. And fortunately for us, you know, Phil is very capable.
So how much do you want to do with Last in Line? And I know you guys are about ready to do a tour.
Yeah.
Is this going to be your second band? Everyone has two bands now.
Everyone seems
right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously I've been very busy the last couple of years with Def Leppard, but I'm very passionate about Last in Line, and I'm very grateful for the response that the Heavy Crown album has gotten. People want us to play, and I certainly want to do it. It's very cathartic for me to get out and play this music. I mean, it really makes me feel alive. And, you know, I've been dealing with a little lymphoma for the last couple of years, too.
Right.
So that's kind of realigned my thought process.
Does it make you realize life's pretty short?
Absolutely, and, yeah. And to really, I take great joy in everything, you know. Every day is to be celebrated, and I absolutely love the feeling of just beating the shit out of my Les Paul again,
which, you know, is great to hear you say, because like I said, for years, like, Fabian, please, and now you're doing it. That's cool as a fan to hear that as well.
Well, thank you. It's great to be aggressive with it. I find it so cathartic, you know. So we will definitely do anything and everything we can with this band.
You want this is a long term. You want to keep growing.
Absolutely, we're already. We've been offered. Frontiers has offered us the opportunity to make another record early next year. So we're definitely going to do that. And that'll be a different and exciting chapter for us, because we'll be writing with Phil for the first time, and with Eric, and so I'm excited about that. You know, we start playing on October 22nd. We got like five shows in Nevada and California, and then we go to Europe and UK for a month. I know it's a lot less than we had originally intended to do to promote this record, but you know. Circumstances
things
were
happened,
what they were, you know. So hopefully, you know, next year in 2017, I know Leppard aren't going to be too busy next year, so I'll have more of an opportunity, and hopefully everyone else's schedule will be clear enough for where we can actually do.
Is it fun for you, Phil, to be in a band where you're going to be playing, you know, original stuff and stuff that you're going to write for again?
Like I said, I love playing in this band, not only because of the classic songs that we do play, and for me that's paying not just tribute, but hopefully doing justice to Jimmy as well. Mm. You know, for our friendships, you know, the time that we spent together, where we were inseparable for a long time, socially and what have you. This is maybe the little thing I can do to bring his product in front of other people and do it justice. But also, you know, for the future as well. And one of the things that I love about this band, and which I think I shared about the Aussie band as well that Viv was touching on earlier, is these bands are basically three-piece bands, and that's what it is.
Right.
So when you look at it, you've got a singer and you've got a three-piece. And it's my favorite format is a three-piece band because you can't mess around. And when a guitar player goes off to play, between the bass player and the drummer, you have to create that canvas, and you can't have any holes in it. Mm-hmm. It's got to be so powerful. And that's something I really learned, I think, with Aussie more than anything else, and maybe that's why walking in and playing with these guys, it's I get that same feeling, and it's very, very gratifying, and it's just wonderful. It really and it's also very tense. I mean, you know, you can't mess up.
You gotta be paying attention.
You know, you are paying attention.
Can't be looking at that chick in the front row.
No, not at all.
There are no chicks.
Dudes in black t-shirts. Yeah.
It's a prison crowd. You know, a lot of bored-looking girlfriends. But you know,
I'm happy to say there are some women who appreciate less and less. That's nice.
A couple last things I have to ask you about Hearing Aid. How cool of a thing that was.
Jimmy's idea.
That was Jimmy's idea.
Yeah, grew out of Jimmy and I were doing an interview on KLOS, the station here, the rock station here in LA. And it was a few weeks or whatever after the We Are the World thing had come out.
Right.
And the DJ, I can't even remember who it was. My apologies. I don't remember who was interviewing us. But they said, you know, how come no one from the hard rock community was invited to We Are the World? You know, it was all these...
The closest was like, Steve Perry, I think, from Journey. Yeah, it's the closest you even came close to being invited.
And and we said, well, because back then, you know, we didn't win Grammys. You know, hard rock was kind of a pariah. You know, it sold millions of records and millions of concert tickets, but didn't really get recognized. Yes. You know, it wasn't legitimate in the eyes of the industry.
Still really doesn't.
But, yeah. So Jimmy, like, right off the cuff, Jimmy said, we should do one of our own. We should call it Hearing Aid. You know? We split our sides laughing. We thought, what a great title. Yeah. Jimmy and I, and this is at the time when Jimmy and I were roommates at one of the Oakwood apartments. So we left the studio and we got back to our apartment that night. And Jimmy said, well, why don't we actually do this for real? And we'll start with the song. So Jimmy and I, we wrote the music for the song. And we knew that we couldn't get anywhere without Ronnie's involvement. We needed a heavy hitter in the industry. No one was going to listen to us. Mm-hmm. So we took the song to Ronnie and said, Ronnie, do you want to get in on this? Do you want to write the lyrics and help us with this? And at the time, we were making The Sacred Heart, the third Dio album. And we were right in the middle of it. We've got a huge workload. And Ronnie basically said, I don't have the time for this diversion. I got to focus on finishing this record. And we said, okay, fair enough. And a week or two later, something changed his mind. He came back. He said, okay, let's do this. And we kicked it around, and he came up with the lyric. And we had a publicist at the time called Sharon Weiss, and Sharon came on board with us, and she was very, very instrumental in helping us contact all these other people. I didn't know hardly anyone in the industry. I literally would go to Sharon's office first thing in the morning. She would hook me up with a phone number to, this is John Bon Jovi's phone number, this is so-and-so's phone number, or if you call this person, you can get their number. And I'm just cold calling.
Calling
people.
Calling
to electric. Yeah, hey, you don't know me. My name is Vivian Campbell. I'm the guitar player with Dio. And just had my spiel done, you know, giving them the whole thing, you know, in a nutshell, like, this is what we're doing. Is there any chance, you know, you can come and play with us? Or calling airlines or hotels or studios, just trying to get everything free, you know? So it was a lot of work, and for a few weeks I didn't play guitar at all. I was just, that was my job, was organizing all of that, you know, and it was quite the event. But I was really glad when it was over. I was knackered.
Was there anybody that you called that you really wanted that just didn't respond?
No, I gotta say, everyone, I mean, a lot of people couldn't make it. I did mention John Bon Jovi, and he couldn't make it, but I did actually reach out to him.
Did you call Van Halen?
I couldn't get a hold of them.
Gotcha. It's a little bit harder, right? Yeah. That's the higher ground.
They're a different level, above my pay grade. I'm happy to say that everyone that I spoke to was up for it. And
that might be Van Halen. He's calling back right now to tell you. Yeah,
I heard you want me for some charity thing.
So you're talking about 1980s, L.A. What was it like recording that with all of those crazy rockers in the studio? Was it pretty debaucherous?
Not that I was aware. I mean, I'm sure if you'd walked into the bathroom, there's probably a few things going on. But again, I mean, I was so preoccupied with looking after everyone and making sure things were... I still had my business hat on when I was doing that, you know. And then at the end of the day, it was like, oh, I got to play a guitar solo. Sorry, forgive my language.
Phil's mum is here.
Yes. Sorry, Miss Suzanne.
After 30 years, 40 years, I'm sure you're used to it.
I got to play a guitar solo. So it was almost like an afterthought. And I remember not wanting to play because Neil Sean was there. And it was the first time I'd really heard what he can do.
He might be the best at all of them.
That was frightening. I mean, he just
I said, stop doing that. Stop showing off. You know, he was so good, you know, and George Lynch and Yngwie, all these great players were there. And I was just, like I said back then, I had no confidence. And whatever confidence I did have was completely eroded that day because I'm in the room with all these great players. So the last thing I wanted to do was a guitar. So I was quite happy to be keeping myself busy rhythms. with well, playing rhythm and making sure that everyone else was you know, got their ride to and from LAX, you know.
You know what I always loved about this, and goes back to your time with the Chuck Berry thing? I love what Adrian Smith and Dave Murray did. Instead of trying to go head-to-head with the guitar players, they did this really cool harmony melody that went underneath the chorus. And I just thought, what a cool way to, like, avoid wanking off. Yeah. Let's just do something really melodic and stick it behind here.
Yeah.
It was kind of a good idea.
Yeah, I love guitar harmony. I mean, Thin Lizzy again, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Scott Gorman and Brian Robertson really...
Yeah,
kind of harmonies, nuanced that. I mean, that was so much a part of Lizzie's sound. But yeah, it definitely is a way to go with two guitar players and make it work more.
Last question. What's your favorite Last in Line song to play, Phil? And what's your favorite Dio song to play in the set?
Well, Devil in Me, I love.
Good tune, yeah.
I love that track. I love playing that track. It's just so heavy.
Yeah.
And there's a pocket in it. And when you sit in that pocket, it's just like a train that's just coming through your front room, you know. It's fantastic. As far as which Dio song, it changes every night. I mean, I think to myself, wow, I love playing We Rock, and then I have a great time playing that, and then it's Don't Talk to Strangers, and I enjoy playing that. I keep cycling around them. Depending. You know, there's no songs I don't like playing, and they're also very, you know, nostalgic as well.
Sure.
So, you know, you get this kind of thing in the back of your neck sometimes where you have to kind of wake up in the middle of a song and you look around and you think, wow, you know, I'm playing this song that I used to admire so much way back when, and there's some validation to it because of the people I'm playing with. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
What you did?
Well, from the new album, from the Heavy Crown album, Star Maker is my absolute favorite to play. I think we play that very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a dynamic song. It's an exciting song to play live. But I do have a second one, Martyr.
Martyr
is so much fun to play. And it's Martyr was a Jimmy riff.
Ah.
Jimmy loved writing in F sharp, and this is one of his. So, but it's such an exciting song to play.
I like F sharp because you don't have to reach all the way down to the open yes, E.
It's where his hand
it's
comfortably
like closer.
Fell.
That yeah, is a just, good Jimmy thing too, by the way.
It just fell on F sharp. Jimmy came up with some great F sharp riffs, and another one which is Jimmy's, which is one of my favorite to play from the Dio catalog, is Straight Through the Heart.
From the
Holy Diver record. Now that again
was a
Jimmy Bain F sharp riff.
Yeah, you know? That's great. Yeah. Man. Well, it's great talking to you guys and some great stories. And I'm really glad that you decided to continue along. I think Phil is the perfect guy for the gig. Well, so
thank you.
We'll see you guys.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
We'll see you guys on the road.
Indeed. All right.
Cheers, Chris.
Cheers, guys.
Last in Line are on the road. The tour starts this Friday, October 21st in Seattle, Washington. They do a handful of dates on the West Coast, then head to Europe. You can get tickets and a copy of the album Heavy Crown at lastinlineofficial.com. It's a great rock and roll record. Definitely has the feel of Holy Diver, of Last in Line, of Sacred Heart. And wait till you hear the rejuvenated Vivian Campbell play some of these amazing, amazing solos. It's awesome to hear him let loose like that. Completely different from what he does with Def Leppard. So get a copy of Heavy Crown. Get your rock on. Support Talk Is Jericho in the process. You know what I'm going to say. You know where you can do it. Go get the album on Amazon and use the Talk Is Jericho links to use it. All my Amazon links are at podcastone.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page. Then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for the USA, the UK, the Canada. Every time you use these links, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover production costs. You can buy just about anything you can think of on Amazon. And using the Amazon Talk Is Jericho links won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees, extra charges. Just go to podcastone.com. Click the Killer Deals button on the top right corner of the page. Then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. All my great sponsors are there as well. BetDSI. Sign up at BetDSI.com. Use the promo code Jericho25 to get $25 for free just to try the service. Win some money. DDP Yoga. Get 15% off the program plus 3 months of full access to the DDP Yoga Now app. Just go to DDPYoga.com/Jericho. Also, don't forget about DraftKings. Use my promo code Y2J to play for free with your first deposit at DraftKings.com. And don't forget, March 15th, 2017. It's the biggest podcast ever. When Mick Foley joins Talk Is Jericho, the countdown clock is running. 146 days until Mick makes his Talk Is Jericho debut. You're not going to want to miss it. And you're not going to want to miss the new addition to the Jericho Network, the debut episode of Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus. Lance Storm and Cyrus, Don Callis, share some stories from their ECW days, a little thought-provoking analysis on Bill Goldberg's return to the WWE, plus the story of the Northern Death Tours. Listen, you want intelligent wrestling conversation, great analysis from two guys with no agenda, nothing to lose, and everything to gain? Go check out Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus on Podcast One. Go to iTunes, hit subscribe on Killing the Town, and be entertained all week long, all week on the Jericho Network. Plus, the Team Tiger Awesome show is on Sunday, Killing the Town on Tuesday, Keep It at 100 with Conan on Thursday, The Runaway Hit, the flagship of the Jericho Network, and of course, Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday. The Jericho Network and Podcast One has you covered. Go to iTunes, hit the subscribe button on all those podcasts. Be sure to leave everyone a 5-star rating and review. Go do it for your mama. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next, and on Friday, before his big title defense at Hell in the Cell, I got WWE Cruiserweight champ TJ Perkins is here. You're going to find out all about TJ. He's been wrestling for 18 years, and he has wrestled everywhere. New Japan, TNA, Mexico, Ring of Honor, and now here he is as the Cruiserweight champion in the WWE. He hasn't had a lot of promo time to explain himself on the show, on Raw, but he's got a lot of promo time coming up on Talk Is Jericho. You're not going to want to miss his inspirational story. WWE Cruiserweight Champion TJ Perkins is here. We'll see you on Friday. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk Is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.